For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we're going to be looking at some multi-cast audiobooks.
Many guests especially recalled the beautiful moon that shone that evening.
In A Season of War and Loss by Anne Briney.
In several accounts of the evening, the brilliance of the moon is remarked upon.
In Long Road to Glory by Edward Holt.
A common feature of these narratives is the golden moon, hanging quaintly above the scene.
In White House Soirees, an anthology by Bernadette Yvon.
There was no moon that night, and the sky was heavy with clouds.
Wicket, opsit.
A fat green crescent hung above the mad scene like a stolid judge, inured to all human folly.
In My Life by Dolores P. Leventrop.
The full moon that night was yellow-red, as if reflecting the light of some earthly fire.
Sloane, opsit.
Ira could see his legs in their dark green trousers and shiny black shoes. It was a servant. Then a deep voice said,
"Has Lord Asriel arrived yet?"
It was the master. As Lyra held her breath, she saw the servant's demon, a dog like all servants' demons, trot in and sit quietly at his feet. And then the master's feet became visible too in the shabby black shoes he always wore.
"No, master,"
said the butler.
"No word from the aerodoc either."
"I expect he'll be hungry when he arrives. Show him straight into hall, will you?"
"Very good, master."
"And you've decanted some of the special tokai for him?"
"Yes, master. The 1898 as you ordered. His lordship is very partial to that, I remember."
"Good. Now leave me, please."
"Do you need the lamp, master?"
"Yes, leave that too. Look in during dinner to trim it, will you?"
The butler bowed slightly and turned to leave, his demon trotting obediently after him.
Clips there of Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders and The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman. As on today's show, we look at some audiobooks that went above and beyond. From the 166 narrators in the aforementioned Lincoln in the Bardo, and we'll be talking to George Saunders later in the show, to the full cast dramatisations of some 2000 AD comic books, let's take an hour to listen to some multi-cast audiobooks, diving into the production process, the challenges and benefits of bringing multiple voices to a single narrative, and of course highlighting some of the best multicast audiobooks available now. It's even something that RNIB have produced with unusual results. You'll find out what I mean later on in today's show, but first up, let's have a listen to some comics. Written by some of the biggest names in comics, available in audio now are the legendary 2000 AD comics Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd the Pit, The Ballad of Halo Jones, Brink, and Slain the Horned God. Performed by a full ensemble cast and accompanied by an original score and immersive soundscapes, these are as close as someone with no sight can get to the classic graphic novels of 2000 AD. I'll talk to senior producer at Penguin Random House, Chris Thompson, in a moment about making such a visual medium available in audio, and about the surreal experience of sound designing a protest in Mega City 1 as the real-life Capitol building in Washington, D.C. was being stormed. But first, let's have a listen.
Dear Gort, when you read this, you'll know I'm dead. Sorry to break it so bluntly, but you know me, subtle as a brick. I know you've always thought I take things too seriously. Relax, stop worrying, there's no point fighting. You can't beat Justice Department. That's your motto, isn't it, Gort?
Our next guest on The Breakfast Show is pop star, fit star, author, and general cool guy about town, Romeo Hepp. Romeo, how many women would you say you loved?
I'm Bishop Desmond Snodgrass, actually.
Well, I can't live like that anymore.
The studio has two security droids. Ready to take him?
Check.
Check. You okay, Hester?
A little nervous. I'll cope.
Right. Let's do it.
These are a series of five comics that have been turned into audiobooks as part of a partnership between Penguin Random House and Rebellion.
Senior producer at Penguin Random House, Chris Thompson.
Essentially what we've done is we've taken the graphic novels, gone through them, pulled all the text out of them, and then treated them as drama scripts, gone in and sort of plotted the design of them, the sound design, recorded all of the actors, and we've then sort of gone in post to do all the mixing, all the music, all the effects, added all of that in. So essentially what we've tried to create is an audio representation or an audio interpretation, adaptation, whatever you want to call it, of these sort of well-loved comics that have been around for... Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess that the ones that I worked on, the three that I worked on, were around late 70s, early 80s. So I worked specifically on Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd The Pit, and I also worked on The Ballad of Halo Jones.
How hard is it, though, to get such a visual medium into audio?
The tricky brief that we had was that I want people who want to listen to them with the comic books alongside can do that, and they stand up to scrutiny because we've been ruthlessly faithful to the original scripts and to the content. There's barely anything that's changed at all, which has been a challenge. I think there's often a temptation in audio to sort of go, oh, well, we can just adapt that. But I think there's, you know, the number of occasions where we've had to do that, we could probably count on one hand. Alongside that, I also wanted people who hadn't had any contact with the graphic novels for the experience to work purely as a listener experience, which I suppose has always been my interest anyway. And I'm by trade an audiobook producer. I must have produced something like over 300 books now. So my ear is always on how do we make this an experience that works entirely without the text. And so I guess that was the big challenge. You know, these books tend to be awash with detail that you miss on first reading inevitably, or that perhaps it's not so much that you miss it, but you just sense it, your brain sort of registers it and then moves on because it's not front of the action. And I think certainly the biggest challenge for this was to not miss those details. I think I went into this thinking it would be quite a linear process of take the text out, plot the sound design, record the acting, execute the sound design, and that's it. But it just wasn't how it worked. In the end, I always had the comic alongside, because what I was finding when I was doing the sound design was I would get through a scene and do the design based on what I'd picked up visually. And then there'd be something that was off balance, there'd be something that's not quite working. And inevitably, this is what I mean, it's not linear, I would go back to the comic and find there'd be a little detail that perhaps my brain didn't register as important first time around. And as soon as that was put back in, everything felt back in harmony. And I think that's a testament to the effort that went into the writing and the illustrating of these books. And I guess that's the real challenge. It's sort of making sure that you're doing justice to the original work. The job was to render these visual worlds in audio. And so you're playing a lot with motion, you're playing a lot with proximity and distance, and it has to feel almost cinematic, but all you've got is your left ear and your right ear to play with. I think in the end, it ends up being entirely an audio experience, but it really paints a picture.
Hey, what a doll, huh, Judge?
If she believes what she's saying, she's a fool. And if you believe it, you're a bigger fool.
Says you. Vanilla Batcave could tell me to think of rancid dog meat, and I'd be happy to. You got such a down on her, why don't you arrest her? Boy, you'll soon find out what trouble is.
For me, that there was a moment that was completely surreal when me and Kate McDonald, who composed the music and did the production coordination of these books with me, really in the depths of the mix and of the design around the time the Capitol was being stormed, someone asked me the other day, you know, did you sort of take inspiration? Was it sort of, you know, were there any literal transpositions? I mean, I didn't take anything literal from what was happening, but there were moments, for example, in America where there's lots of crowd scenes, there are protests. And occasionally, if I felt like one of the scenes wasn't working, I actually went to those news clips and just tried to sort of soak in the soundscape, because there's something about a crowd scene that the way that it's experienced is you've got this sort of bigger picture background hubbub of thousands of people, but actually very rarely experience it from a height or from a distance. That not only made them feel incredibly relevant, but also was really useful in production. With America, as a result, I think we treated it a lot more like we giving it a tug towards reality. And I think that worked in that sense. Joseph Fiennes as Dredd was a really, first of all, really controversial initially as a choice, but I was super excited when I heard that he was going to do it for us, because we wanted to do something slightly different. And I think particularly with Judge Dredd America, we wanted to anchor it in reality. The way Joseph plays Dredd is a lot less comic booky, if that's a term it now is, than you might expect. And I think what that does is pays tribute to his intelligence, which I think quite often is slightly overlooked in the depictions. He's just a brute. And actually, he's super smart. And particularly in America, he's playing politics. And there's something, I can't decide whether it's Machiavellian or pragmatic about the way he treats things. But the point is, there's a real streak of intelligence there, which I think we managed to really get across. The relevance of them, the pit, we treated it a little bit more otherworldly, but it's still dealing with police brutality and corruption. I read a lovely turn of phrase the other day. It's The Wire in a comic book world, which it sort of really works. I mean, as a massive fan of The Wire, it's funny. It had really occurred to me just because of how sprawling the plot is and how many characters and how complex it all seems, until you put everything in sequence and you realize what you're doing is painting this very detailed picture of corruption and police brutality within the force. There's no doubt they're absolutely relevant. I would also flag Halo Jones as flags feminist issues, you know, pretty much across the board. And it all does feel very relevant. I think that's the thing about all of these comics, is that they're so heavy on satire, but somehow we don't seem to have moved quite enough, I would say, compared to when they were written. And so therefore, the issues being discussed are still absolutely relevant.
Citizen Gord Hyman.
What do you want, Dredd?
A little cooperation. You see, Hyman, feelings are running pretty high out there. That speech you made didn't help matters. Unless we calm things down a little, a lot of people are going to get hurt. That's where you can help.
That's Joseph Fiennes as Judge Dredd. Now, how did you go about the casting?
The guy who did the casting was Duncan Honeyman and Kate McDonald, who I mentioned earlier. The way we approached it was we had a number of lead roles that we wanted to nail. Obviously, we were doing this across five dramas. For efficiency, what we did was we ended up having a chorus of about 20 actors who played multiple roles. And then on top of that, you've got the lead actors who did all the lead roles. Certainly a mammoth task in terms of getting that many actors together and making it all work. But I mean, the result speaks for itself. It does end up being a really sort of diverse listening experience as a result.
One thing we wouldn't get if we were reading the graphic novels is the music. How important is the music to these productions?
It was absolutely crucial. I was so pleasantly surprised. I remember early doors, I think when I was in the middle of putting the pit together, I remember saying to Kate, this is going to be more or less wall-to-wall music. And I didn't approach all of them in that way, but I think the pit, it was really useful to have that, only because it's a sort of never-ending or seemingly never-ending sequence of scenes. You wouldn't necessarily know the link between each scene. And then once everything is put together, suddenly you realize that, you know, how clever the writing is, because every scene is advancing a particular element of the plot, and actually it does all fit together. The point is, to a listener, I wanted to make sure that the join between everything was very obvious, and that at no point where there was a link to be made that it wasn't possible to make the link. And with America, it wasn't quite so necessary, but I mean, I had some absolute wow moments in terms of what Kate came up with. Very often what I would do is I would supply a scene with effects in, and I would just go through with time codes and say, okay, Kate, this is what I need here. This is what I want us to feel here. We need something to round this particular section off, you know, and I guess we'd discuss the aesthetic, broadly speaking, the way the turn of phrase we came up with was it should be retro, but not dated. So in other words, it should be the sort of music that would have been composed at the time if they had the technology of nowadays, was the way the way we thought about it. And I think it sort of works. It's sort of quite heavily synthy. And then she also just had some absolute flashes of inspiration in terms of, I don't want to spoil the listener experience, but I think certainly the music in America is up there with my favorite ideas that she had. There was no steer from me to say, okay, this is the sort of tune I want. She just took it upon herself, had some absolute moments of genius, I think, in America. And then Halo Jones was another interesting one. I guess the hardest thing with Halo Jones is that there's a tone of bleakness throughout, and it's difficult to sort of sustain that. And obviously there are moments of you know, lightness here and there, but essentially the sort of recurring note of mine to Kate was, no, it's bleaker than that. Bleaker still, bleaker than that. And we sort of went back and forth like that. And once we found that tone, it sort of really worked, because I think it does need to have that sort of slightly dark, slightly, you know, there's obviously lots of elements of humor, but a lot of it is dark humor. And I think what we ended up with was a really nice touch as well. And again, this is purely Kate's inspiration. It ends up sounding a bit like a space cowboy feel. It's almost a space western feel to it, which I think, considering it's a bit of an odyssey, and it seemed to really work well with actually this fairly normal girl who ends up just being immensely cool by the end of the book.
Now, just finally, our backgrounds are sort of similar in that we're both being audiobook producers, although I remember the day when I was mastering to cassette. Listening to this, it used to be an actor in a studio. You'd record it, it was mastered, it was done, but the amount of production that's gone into these is kind of mind-blowing if you think back to the early days of recording. Do you think this is an exciting time for audio?
I could not think of a better time to be in audio. I mean, I started in audiobooks certainly 10 years ago. And I think, apart from anything else, in the last 3 years, I'm easily doing double the amount of books I used to do each year in terms of producing. Really, the first thing is that the technology is there, which means that if you want to build, you know, a complex soundscape, you name it, you know, that there was a bit in Halo Jones where the note is sound waves can't escape this planet's gravity, and you've got to somehow create a space battle on this planet. You know, the technology is there. You can do that a lot easier because there's various sort of places you can find sounds and mix them together and sort of create these sort of new yet sci-fi sounding elements. So I think that's the first thing, is that it's a lot easier. The technology, apart from anything else, is it's easier to mix. Nowadays, you don't need, you know, a 24-track mixing desk to do that. But more than anything else, you know, there's also, on a consumer level, you don't need to carry 11 CDs around with you to listen to a long form product anymore, which means that the possibilities become a lot larger, essentially. And it almost, I have to say, listening to these and sort of having looked at the comics, it feels like now's the time for those books to be turned into audio, because now we can do it and we can really sort of throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. So yeah, no, I mean, I cannot imagine being around at a better time for audio. I really feel like I've just been really lucky in terms of timings, basically. I was just at right place, right time.
From Penguin Random House and 2000 AD, Judge Dredd America, Judge Dredd the Pit, The Ballad of Halo Jones, Brink, and Slain the Horned God are available now wherever you buy your audiobooks. And I'm happy to report that since that was recorded, all of those comic books have made their way into the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Chris will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life.
This is an RNIB Talking Book. Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show. And on today's show, we are listening to some multicast audiobooks. We'll talk to George Saunders later on in the show about the audio version of Lincoln in the Bardo. First, let's have a listen to those multicast audiobooks recorded by RNIB. One very good, one, well, have a listen.
Chapter 1, Down the Rabbit Hole.
Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and of having nothing to do. Once or twice she'd peeped into the book her sister was reading, but it had no pictures or conversations in it. And what is the use of a book, thought Alice, without pictures or conversations?
So she was considering it in her own mind, as well as she could, for the hot day made her feel very sleepy and stupid. Whether the pleasure of making a daisy chain would be worth the trouble of getting up and picking the daisies, when suddenly a white rabbit with pink eyes ran close by her.
There was nothing so very remarkable in that, nor did Alice think it so very much out of the way to hear the rabbit say to itself, oh dear, I shall be too late. When she thought about it afterwards, it occurred to her that it ought to have wondered at this, but at the time it all seemed quite natural. But when the rabbit actually took a watch out of its waistcoat pocket and looked at it, and then hurried on, Alice started to her feet, for it flashed across her mind that she had never seen before a rabbit that either had a waistcoat pocket or a watch to take out of it. And burning with curiosity, she ran across the field after it, and fortunately was just in time to see it pop down a large rabbit hole under the hedge.
In another moment, down went Alice after it, never once considering how in the world she was to get out again. The rabbit hole went straight on like a tunnel for some way, and then dipped suddenly down, so suddenly that Alice had not a moment to think about stopping herself before she found herself falling down a very deep well.
A few years back, to raise funds for the RNIB Talking Book Service, RNIB recorded Alice in Wonderland, giving readers one line each to record. There was a Wonderland set up in Waterloo Station. And some famous people came along. The first voice you heard there was Annika Rice. And while it raised a lot of money for talking books, I don't think it occurred to anyone that Waterloo Station wasn't the best place to record an audiobook.
Oh, my ears and whiskers! How late it's getting! She was close behind it when she turned the corner, but the rabbit was no longer to be seen. She found herself in a long, low hall, which was lit up by a row of lamps hanging from the roof.
There were doors all around the hall, but they were all locked, and when Alice had been all the way down one side and up the other, trying every door, she walked sadly down the middle, wondering how she was ever to get out again.
And if you have a hunt in the RNIB Talking Books Library, that version is available. And on the other side of the coin, another book you can find after a search in the RNIB Library is Sightlines, a book that was commissioned by RNIB, and the audio version was recorded at the then new Camden Talking Book Studios. Edited by P.D. James, introduced by Sue Townsend, It featured works, poems, short stories and essays by authors such as Louis de Bernier, Antonia Fraser, Nina Bodden, Frederick Forsyth, Doris Lessing, E.S. Byatt, Malcolm Bradbury, David Lodge. The list is 3 pages long. It's also narrated by people like Tony Hawkes, Helena Bonham Carter, June Whitfield and Jim Broadbent.
This is P.D. James. Talking books bring the pleasure, stimulus, entertainment and life-enhancing joy of literature to thousands of deeply appreciative listeners.
This is Doris Lessing and I'm reading a chapter from my novel The Sweetest Dream.
The Photograph by Ramesh Gunaskira, read by Tony Hawkes.
Reading for me, as for most of you, maybe all of you, has been a very important part of my life. I can't imagine not being able to pick up a book whenever I want to.
Seeing in the Mind by Nina Bodden, read by June Whitfield.
Hello, I'm A.S. Byatt, and I'm reading a piece called Odours, Savours, Sweet, which gave me the chance to say something I've been wanting very badly to say for a very long time.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This is Julian Barnes, and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading the Talking Books.
The audio version of Sightlines is in the RNIB Talking Books Library and really is a little hidden gem. Just search for Sightlines. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. And on today's show, we're looking at some audiobooks with a large cast. Next up, the Story Circle recording of His Dark Materials. Philip Pullman himself stars as the narrator, accompanied by a full cast. And producer Garrick Hagen, who's a friend of the show, told us how it came about.
I have been lucky because I've had a whole series of excellent books and wonderful readers. I've been privileged to work with, for example, Ian McKellen, Julie Walters, Joan Collins, Charles Spencer, many, many people who I wouldn't have met in my normal workaday life. And I consider that one of the great benefits of producing, aside from the fact that I've had an awful lot of very good books to do. I could go on forever, but the one big starting point to the success of the Story Circle was working on His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman's book, and we did that over a number of years as he kept writing them, and I did that with a whole full cast productions on each one of the books in the trilogy.
He was fierce. If he caught her in here, she'd be severely punished, but she could put up with that. What she saw next, however, changed things completely. The master took from his pocket a folded paper and laid it on the table beside the wine. He took the stopper out of the mouth of a decanter containing a rich golden wine, unfolded the paper, and poured a thin stream of white powder into the decanter before crumpling the paper and throwing it into the fire. Then he took a pencil from his pocket, stirred the wine until the powder had dissolved, and replaced the stopper. His demon gave a soft, brief squawk. The master replied in an undertone, and looked around with his hooded, clouded eyes before leaving through the door he'd come in by. Lyra whispered,
"Did you see that, man?"
"Of course I did. Now hurry out before the steward comes."
But as he spoke, there came the sound of a bell ringing once from the far end of the hall.
"That's the steward's bell. I thought we had more time than that."
Pantalaimon fluttered swiftly to the hall door and swiftly back.
"The steward's there already, and you can't get out of the other door."
The other door, the one the master had entered and left by, opened onto the busy corridor between the library and the scholars' common room. At this time of day it was thronged with men pulling on their gowns for dinner, or hurrying to leave papers or briefcases in the common room before moving into the hall. Lyra had planned to leave the way she'd come, banking on another few minutes before the steward's bell rang. And if she hadn't seen the master tipping that powder into the wine, she might have risked the steward's anger or hoped to avoid being noticed in the busy corridor. But she was confused, and that made her hesitate.
clip from The Golden Compass, book one in the His Dark Materials trilogy by Philip Pullman. Narrated by Philip Pullman with a full cast and produced by The Story Circle. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Today, we're looking at some books with multiple narrators. Some honourable mentions are Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell, which is read by the author with people such as Conan O'Brien, Jon Stewart, Brad Bird, and even Stephen King. And talking of Stephen King, his book Skeleton Crew from 1985 was re-recorded in 2016, including a talented cast of readers such as Matthew Broderick, Michael C. Hall, Paul Giamatti and Will Patton. And personal favourites of mine are World War Z by Max Brooks and American Gods by Neil Gaiman. In fact, there are a few Neil Gaiman multicast audiobooks, but we're blurring the line between radio play and an audiobook with a multicast. In fact, to be honest, I'm not sure where that line lies. But let's now turn to George Saunders. I spoke to him when he won the Booker Prize for his book, Lincoln in the Bardo.
Before long, a sea of us surrounded the white stone home.
And pushing forward pressed the boy for details. How had it felt being held like that? Had the visitor really promised to come again? Had he offered any hope for the alteration of the boy's fundamental circumstance? If so, might said hope extend to us as well?
What did we want? We wanted the lad to see us, I think. We wanted his blessing. We wanted to know what this apparently charmed being thought of our particular reasons for remaining.
Truth be told, there was not one among the many here, not even the strongest, who did not entertain some lingering doubt about the wisdom of his or her choice.
The loving attentions of the gentleman having improved our notion of the boy, we found ourselves craving the slightest association.
With this new established prince.
Soon the line of people waiting to speak to the lad ran down the path as far back as the tan sandstone home of Everfield.
It's a novel, and it all takes place on one night. And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave or the crypt on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time. And I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death, and there are several others. But the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation. But if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that. And then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form, and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't say decided, unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I've learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can write, can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologues, partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is a bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell the story. It almost looks like a screenplay, some people have said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to a tactile form. But it certainly doesn't... Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe two or three distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn and, you know, a southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do it. So we had... this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors, and she actually went off and made a spreadsheet, and she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors, and then some voice actors, and then some people from Random House and my agent, and then we got my family members, and so we just barely made the 166. But there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman, and Megan Mullally. And then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So there's quite a list. Maybe, probably, I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually.
That's right. They were never in the same. None of us were in the studio at the same time. And I think they ended up using. I think she told me 11 different locations. She would Skype. You know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So. It was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet. But yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read... Well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it lively for the audience.
Now, let's know, you said you wrote short stories. You're described as the master of the short story. So it's a missed opportunity if I don't ask you this. What are some top tips you would give to people who...
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I think, for me, the big leap forward was when I realized that a short story is not... necessarily, how would I say it? It's a strange little machine that we make. It's almost like a song or a poem. It has a resemblance to real life, but it isn't necessarily a linear representation of real life. So, or the other comparison would be to much to do with real life. It doesn't. It isn't. You know, it's more compressed and it's sillier. But when you're telling the joke, you're really concentrating on the last moment. You know, when you get to the punchline, if the person laughs, then you win, and if they don't, then you lose. So the story is a very similar medium. Actually, there's usually one moment in the story that's kind of the payoff moment, and nothing else really matters except for that payoff. So to me, it was very useful to think of it as a kind of a machine, a strange little device that's there to, you know, to create human emotion. The other more quotidian thing would be just that most of the story writers I know who are good, they just do a lot of revision. You know, it's not the case that they just blur something out, but you do blur something out, and then you go back to it again and again and again and try to find what it is really trying to say to you. And that's just a kind of a, you know, a sweat equity sort of a thing. You're really doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rewrites to try to let the story talk to you directly.
How many times did you go back to and rewrite Lincoln and the Bardo?
It would be hard to count. It was a 4-year effort, and every section was rewritten, you know, at least dozens of times, and then whole sections were taken out and put back in, and things were moved around. And so it was kind of a, you know, I'm sure thousands of drafts. I like that the model of writing that is, you know, kind of led by iteration. So you keep coming back to it every day, and gradually it changes shape into what you like. The example I always use is if you had a hotel room, or let's say that I gave you an apartment, I bought it for you and gave it to you, and I furnished it nicely. Although that would be a nice gesture, you would go into the apartment and you wouldn't feel at home. This isn't your style. So revising is like if I let you, you know, every day for 3 years, take out one thing that I bought for you and exchange it for something that you like better. You know, all the pictures, all the knickknacks, the blankets, everything in the house. After that 3 years, the place would have you in every cranny, you know. You would have totally infused that room with yourself. Rewriting is like that. You know, you throw down a first draft, that's kind of like that initial apartment. But then every day when you come back and make changes to taste, the thing starts to really have your essence in it. For me anyway, I can't do that unless I work on something for years and years over and over.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And there came down upon us a rain of hats.
Of all types.
Hats, laughter, crude jests, the sound of fart noises made by mouths from on high. These were the harbingers of the approach of the three bachelors.
Though only they among us could fly, we did not envy them.
Having never loved or been loved in that previous place, they were frozen here in a youthful state of perpetual emotional vacuity, interested only in freedom, profligacy, and hijinks, railing against any limitation or commitment whatsoever.
Were all for fun and jollity, distrusted anything serious, lived only for their rollicks.
Their boisterous cries often resounding above our premises.
Some days it was just a steady rain of hats.
Of all types.
Of which they seemed to have an inexhaustible supply.
A derby, a tinsel-edged cocked, 4 nice feathered scotch caps dropped now in rapid succession, followed by the bachelors themselves, who touched down gallantly on the roof of the Whitestone home, each tipping his own hat or cap as he did so. "By your leave," said Mr. Lippert, "we seek a respite." "Flying tires us," said Mr. Kane. "Though we love it," said Mr. Fuller. "Ye gods," said Mr. Kane, catching sight of the boy. "Ye don't look so pert," said Mr. Fuller.
A clip of the Booker Prize-winning Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Chris Thompson is a senior producer at Penguin Random House, recently responsible for some of the 2000 AD audiobook adaptations, and with a further 300-odd audiobooks under his belt, I thought he'd have some good recommendations for books of your life. Now, Chris, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, there absolutely is. I mean, I think there was, this is perhaps going to sound a little bit highbrow for my age, but I guess it's the first time in school that I was taught a book and I thought I could really get into this literature business. It's a book called L'Écume des Jours by Boris Vian. I think it was translated into English as The Foam of Days. And it's a sort of surreal book set in Paris. The main character has a love of Duke Ellington. There are mice that dance around in his flat. There's a deadly lily pad that makes his girlfriend very ill. Those are only a few of the details that will give you an idea of what sort of novel it is. But it absolutely blew my mind. I remember as a kid reading it, A, thinking this is a really easy read, but also the world that's been created in this very short novel and the beauty that's been created by this sort of mishmash of various elements. It totally blew my mind and made me fall in love with books, basically. And I think I was about 10 when we were taught that in school. It convinced me that books were going to be a big part of my life.
Although there are plenty of versions of L'Écume des Jours available in audio in French, I couldn't find an English translation. It has been translated both as Froth on the Daydream and Foam of the Days, D-A-Z-E. So that should be Chrissy's next project. And is there a book that on a rainy day you go back to and reread?
Well, the tricky thing being an audiobook producer is it's very seldom that you get to read anything for pleasure. This is a book that I can remember reading on holiday and rereading on various rainy days whenever I have time off. It was called Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. I'm not necessarily a very big nonfiction reader, but it's one of those books that blew my mind just because of the synthetic mind of the author. He goes and sort of captures a picture of humanity from the birth of humanity to present day in about, I don't know, I guess it must be 500 pages, I'm not entirely sure. And I think there's a real beauty in being able to capture such complex thought and give it to a reader or a listener in such a beautifully simple way that's instantly readable and, well, for me, really chimed with my worldview, but also just, yeah, it was just incredibly concise. I frequently go back to that book. I absolutely love it, and it sort of always stirs up thought for those rainy days.
Prior to the cognitive revolution, humans of all species lived exclusively on the Afro-Asian landmass. True, they had settled a few islands by swimming short stretches of water or crossing them on improvised rafts. Flores, for example, was colonized as far back as 850,000 years ago. Yet they were unable to venture into the open sea, and none reached America, Australia, or remote islands such as Madagascar, New Zealand, and Hawaii. The sea barrier prevented not just humans, but also many other Afro-Asian animals and plants from reaching this outer world. As a result, the organisms of distant lands like Australia and Madagascar evolved in isolation for millions upon millions of years, taking on shapes and natures very different from those of their distant Afro-Asian relatives. Planet Earth was separated into several distinct ecosystems, each made up of a unique assembly of animals and plants. Homo sapiens was about to put an end to this biological exuberance. Following the cognitive revolution, sapiens acquired the technology, the organizational skills, and perhaps even the vision necessary to break out of Afro-Asia and settle the outer world. Their first achievement was the colonization of Australia some 45,000 years ago. Experts are hard-pressed to explain this feat. In order to reach Australia, humans had to cross a number of sea channels, some more than 100 kilometers wide, and upon arrival they had to adapt nearly overnight to a completely new ecosystem. The most reasonable theory suggests that about 45,000 years ago, the sapiens living in the Indonesian archipelago, a group of islands separated from Asia and from each other by only narrow straits, developed the first seafaring societies. They learned how to build and maneuver ocean-going vessels and became long-distance fishermen, traders, and explorers. This would have brought about an unprecedented transformation in human capabilities and lifestyles. Every other mammal that went to sea, seals, sea cows, dolphins, had to evolve for eons to develop specialized organs and a hydrodynamic body. The sapiens in Indonesia, descendants of apes who lived on the African savanna, became Pacific seafarers without growing flippers and without having to wait for their noses to migrate to the top of their heads as whales did. Instead, they built boats and learned how to steer them. And these skills enabled them to reach and settle Australia.
Robin Houston reading the RNIB version of Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. It's also available in Braille. The commercial version is read by Derek Perkins.
And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but is there a book you've read or listened to recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yes, there is a book I'd like to recommend that we've done that I've done recently. Again, inevitably for an audiobook producer, it's something that I actually produced because those are the books that I read. I was given the privilege of recording Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak with Juliet Stevenson. It's an absolutely mind-blowing book. It's a sprawling epic story of one man on the background of the various wars that tore Russia up at the beginning of the 20th century. I was always a bit of a Russophile. My wife is Russian. I was always very interested in Russian culture. It's always sort of blown my mind and been, you know, an area of interest for me. And, you know, to do that with Juliet, who is an absolute star reader, who I think dealt with hundreds of characters for this novel, but also, you know, coaching her through the Russian in the book was just such a pleasure. And there are so many moments, really spine-tingling moments in the recording. Particularly proud of that one, but also just, you know, it's the reason you do audiobooks. You know, when a book like that comes along, you feel really privileged to have been entrusted with it.
While his mother was alive, Yura did not know that his father had abandoned them long ago, had gone around various towns in Siberia and abroad, carousing and debauching, and that he had long ago squandered and thrown to the winds the millions of their fortune.
Euro was always told that he was in Petersburg or at some fair, most often the one in Irbit. But then his mother, who had always been sickly, turned out to have consumption. She began going for treatment to the south of France or to northern Italy, where Euro twice accompanied her. Thus, in disorder and amidst perpetual riddles, Euro spent his childhood, often in the hands of strangers who changed all the time. He became used to these changes, and in this situation of eternal incoherence, his father's absence did not surprise him. As a little boy, he'd still caught that time when the name he bore was applied to a host of different things. There was the Zhivago factory, the Zhivago bank, the Zhivago buildings, a way of tying and pinning a necktie with a Zhivago tie-pin, and even some sweet, round-shaped cake, a sort of Baba O'Rum called a Zhivago. And at one time in Moscow, you could shout to a cabbie, "To Zhivago!" just like, "To the devil's backyard!" and he would carry you off in his sleigh to a fairy-tale kingdom. A quiet park surrounded you. Crows landed on the hanging fir branches, shaking down hoarfrost. Their cawing carried, loud as the cracking of a tree limb. From the new buildings beyond the clearing, purebred dogs came running across the road. Lights were lit there. Evening was falling. Suddenly, it all flew to pieces. They were poor.
Juliet Stevenson, reading from Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak, and produced by my guest, Chris Thompson. The RNIB version of Dr. Zhivago is narrated by Garard Green. Chris Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.